I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Foodborne illnesses are back in the news. A recent outbreak of E. coli has sickened more than 100 people in 6 different states. In 2015, the FDA estimated that as many as 48 million Americans suffered from a foodborne illness. Nearly 130,000 people were hospitalized. Perhaps as many as 3,000 people may have died. Has food safety become more reliable in the past few years? My guest has devoted his career to seeing that the food supply does remain safe and that science and technology are employed for the public good. Dr. Michael Jacobson is the co-founder and chief scientist of the Center for Science in the Public Interest. He joins me to talk about the latest research that can inform our approach to public policy and individual behavior. First, the news. Good afternoon and welcome. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining me today for Midday. Today, we're going to have a conversation about food safety and nutrition with the co-founder of the Center for Science in the Public Interest. But before we begin that discussion, a brief update on the situation in Baltimore City government. Today, Mayor Catherine Pugh begins the third week of a paid indefinite leave of absence as she continues her convalescence from pneumonia. On Friday, the Greater Baltimore Committee joined the chorus of those calling for the mayor to resign. In a move that he claims is unrelated to the mayor's current challenges, the head of the Baltimore Development Corporation, William Cole IV, announced this morning that he is leaving his post to join a consulting firm founded by former Howard County Executive Ken Ullman. Cole has headed the BDC for about 5 years. The BDC board has appointed Colin Tarbert to replace him. He's been the city's deputy chief of strategic alliances. That office was run by Jim Smith, the former Baltimore County executive. Last week, Smith also announced that he was leaving city government. Mayor Pugh continues to be the subject of investigations by at least 3 state and city agencies. We'll keep you updated on developments here on Midday, and the WIPR news team will, of course, have continuing coverage. We are also very indebted to the Baltimore Sun, the Baltimore Brew, the Baltimore Business Journal, and the Daily Record for their outstanding coverage of this very important moment in our city's history. So now on to our topic for today. For most of the past half century, the Center for Science in the Public Interest has been on the front line of a campaign to improve food safety and nutrition in the United States. In 1990, the center pushed Congress to pass the law requiring standardized nutrition information labels on all food packages. It helped win passage of laws requiring calorie information on chain restaurant menus, and it went to court to stop deceptive advertising and marketing of foods and dietary supplements. It's lobbied to strengthen food safety laws and ban junk food from schools, and it prodded the Food and Drug Administration to eliminate artificial trans fats from the food supply. My guest is Dr. Michael Jacobson. He co-founded the Center for Science in the Public Interest in 1971. He's a microbiologist, and he was the executive director of the center until 2017. He now serves as its senior scientist. Jacobson is the author of several books, including The Complete Eater's Digest and Nutrition Scoreboard. Dr. Jacobson will be in Baltimore Wednesday night to participate on a panel called Pleasures or Poisons, the Science and Culture of Food. That event is part of the Great Talk series, and Michael Jacobson joins me from the studios of NPR in Washington. Dr. Jacobson, welcome.
Good afternoon. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thanks for your time. And listeners, if you'd like to join our conversation with Michael Jacobson, our number here on Midday, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. You can drop us a tweet at @MiddayWIPR. So, Mike Jacobson, when it comes to food safety, we have just in the last week or so another report of a major outbreak of E. coli, more than 100 people affected across 6 different states. How do these bacterial outbreaks happen, and what should we be doing to make them a less common occurrence?
Well, it's frustrating, isn't it, that we've had these foodborne illness outbreaks really from time immemorial, but as detection methods have gotten better, there's been more publicity about them. The biggest step to improving food safety, not just from ground beef or all meats, but also fruits, vegetables, and sprouts, was the Food Safety Modernization Act, which was passed in 2011. And the theory behind that law was to prevent foodborne illnesses rather than detecting them and then trying to protect people. So the prevention is a very important aspect. So that's a 2011 law. It won't be fully implemented for 3 more years. And, reflects a lot of frustration, but it also reflects how difficult, how complicated our food system is. To go back to farms of all different types, transportation, packing houses, food manufacturing facilities, and try to design rules and regulations that are nuanced enough to prevent food safety problems without bankrupting everybody from farmers to delivery drivers.
Since 2015, the FDA and others have reported that perhaps as many as 48 million Americans a year were getting foodborne illness. That's 4 years ago. You mentioned this law that was passed in 2011 but not fully in place for several more years. But has it gotten better since 2011? Are we better at detecting and, in fact, preventing some of these illnesses from starting in the first place?
Well, I think we're better at preventing some of them. Whether that, or to what extent that's impacting the number of illnesses and deaths, nobody knows. The Centers for Disease Control comes up with those figures of illnesses, hospitalizations, and deaths every 10 years, maybe. And it hasn't come up with a new set of estimates. My hunch is it probably hasn't been affected a whole lot, hopefully some. And so to some extent, the consumers have to protect themselves. And with meat and poultry, the easiest way to do it is to cook the food thoroughly. If you cook it so it's hot throughout, you'll kill the germs and protect yourself.
Even something like E. coli, if you cook it thoroughly, yeah.
That's right. And if you're cooking a steak or hamburger, ideally you'd use a meat thermometer. The Department of Agriculture has been recommending that for decades. I suspect that not many people do that. Fruits and vegetables are harder, especially the ones we eat raw, lettuce, for instance. You can wash it. That helps a little bit. But bacteria grab onto every nook and crevice they can find. And so it's really impossible to wash them all off. For something like cucumber, maybe scraping them with a vegetable brush helps a little. So we need to take those steps. And it may be that we're going to have foodborne illnesses forever, and all we can do is hope to reduce the number.
But particularly in an environment now in Washington that is an anti-regulatory environment, and indeed President Trump was elected in part on his vow to attenuate various regulations across a number of different industries. Is it a matter of not enough inspectors or resistance, recalcitrance on the part of the beef industry or the meat industry, the meat packing industry in general? I mean, how do you assess the current problem in terms of what the government could be doing and may or may not be doing to address it?
Well, for starters, let me be generous. The man that Trump appointed to be the Commissioner of Food and Drugs, Scott Gottlieb, was probably the best appointment he made out of the hundreds that he's made. Gottlieb has been a very conscientious public servant. Unfortunately, he quit 2 weeks ago. So
right.
I think unrelated to Trump, but I don't know the inside story. But the politics have been there forever. And when you think farm state members of Congress, mostly Republican but also Democrats, are very powerful, and they certainly have slowed down progress. The general Republican attitude of let's defund government hasn't helped. When you think of, you mentioned inspectors, and that's extremely important. The Department of Agriculture has done some farming out of food inspections, giving more responsibility to the companies at packing houses, and that's not going to help. So it's a perpetual problem of battles in Congress, and then the president could exert influence one way or another. So that stuff is going on at the political level. For your listeners, it's really a matter of being careful. Keep hot foods hot, cold foods cold. When you eat out and you see cockroaches crawling around on a restaurant floor, leave. So there are certain things we could do to protect ourselves, but only up to a point. Ideally, the food would be perfectly clean when it enters a supermarket or a restaurant.
Michael Jacobson is a co-founder of the Center for Science in the Public Interest. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, to drop us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. When it comes to what we can do individually to protect ourselves, how about organic foods? Are they, particularly when you mentioned lettuces and things that we're eating raw, is an organic product fundamentally and sort of inherently safer, more safe than a non-organic product?
In one way, it is. Those foods have not been sprayed with potentially toxic pesticides, though the risk from pesticides is really quite low. But you are a little safer in that regard. But in terms of pathogens in the food, they're the same risks, and people have to be careful. You have to exercise the same kinds of protective measures, cooking foods, washing foods, and so on.
Because a lot of the problem, as I understand it, this goes back some years. I mean, in 1993, there was an E. coli outbreak linked to hamburgers sold at a fast food chain called Jack in the Box. It has to do with the contamination of meat during the slaughtering process, fecal contamination, which, of course, if it's in the manure that's used to fertilize organic fields, it's the E. coli bacteria is still going to be existent in an organic product as well. I mean, is this a matter of industry self-monitoring itself?
Well, there's certainly that element, but which industry should do. Farmers who are raising fruits and vegetables need to be cautious about their methods. The FDA and state inspectors soon will be going out to farms to see if they're adhering to the regulations that the FDA has adopted. So one simple thing, though maybe expensive, is to keep cattle and feedlots in particular far away from vegetable farms, because there's suspicion that, as you mentioned, pathogen-contaminated manure can get in, gets deposited on the land. Rains come, germs can wash into irrigation water. So, and then, you know, things that are really impossible to control, deer getting into farm fields, birds flying over the fields and leaving their contaminated droppings on produce. So it really is quite complicated.
You are the Center for Science in the Public Interest is one of the complainants in a lawsuit filed just earlier this month against the Trump administration's so-called rollback rule, which they published in December a few months ago. This has to do with school nutrition. Is there an anti-regulatory dimension to the food safety when it comes from farms and animal products. I mean, is there a parallel, for example, and I have no idea whether there is or not, so I'm asking, is there a parallel between food safety regulations and, say, transportation regulations, where we heard a lot about the Boeing company, being in charge of inspecting their planes on their own because there certainly just aren't enough inspectors who are independent of the company and independent of all airlines going around and making sure that repairs are done correctly and updates are installed correctly. Are there any parallels in the food safety realm?
Well, I mentioned one, and that's the farming out of more inspection responsibilities in hog slaughterhouses, something the Department of Agriculture just decided a few weeks ago. And then there's that downward pressure on government funding that in industry doesn't like regulations. They don't like enforcement of regulations. But, you know, that's tempered by the devastation to industries that foodborne illness outbreaks can cause. So the spinach industry, spinach growers were devastated, 10 years ago or so, when spinach was found to be contaminated. And really, consumption dropped through the floor. Romaine lettuce was something earlier this year or last year where they were tremendously affected. So the farmers and industry hopefully understand that the government regulations protect them as well as consumers. But that's an easy lesson to forget. So
yeah.
When you have the inspector knocking at your door.
Yeah, talk to a spinach grower or somebody who runs a Chipotle franchise. I mean, you know, when these things happen, boy, it is bad for business. Dr. Yeah. Michael Jacobson is the co-founder and senior scientist at the Center for Science in the Public Interest. It's a food safety and nutrition watchdog group. We'll have more with Dr. Jacobson after a short break. When we come back, we invite your questions and comments at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, to send us a tweet at midday. WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WIPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up tomorrow on our program, Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. We're going to talk about the horrible problem of sex trafficking. Sherry and I will be joined by Jessica Emerson. She's the director of the University of Baltimore's Human Trafficking Project, and Jean Alert, the founder of the Samaritan Women Institute for Shelter Care. So that's coming up tomorrow on Midday. If you've just joined us today, my guest is Dr. Michael Jacobson, the senior scientist at the Center for Science in the Public Interest. We're talking about food safety and nutrition. We'll take your calls and comments at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. Have you heard, if you've got school-aged children, for example, listeners, have you heard about this rollback to the regulations that were suggested some years back about salt, for example, and salt content in foods? If that is affecting your family and your children, give us a call, 410-662-8780. So, Dr. Jacobson, let's talk a little bit about salt. This is an area that you've concentrated a good bit of your professional energy over the years. There's a thing called the Salt Institute. It's been around for a long time, 100 years or something, and it has just dissolved. This was an industry advocacy group, an industry network, and they no longer exist. What's going on in the salt business these days?
Well, two cheers for the Salt Institute for dissolving. Over the years, it's been nothing but an impediment to getting the truth out and getting government and industry to act responsibly. But I see salt as the single most harmful substance in our food supply. There are a number of academic studies indicating that excess salt or sodium is causing as many as 100,000 deaths every year. you know, dwarfing practically everything else related to food, including pathogens. And so we've worked very hard to reduce sodium levels, and we're seeing a little bit of progress. But again, things are so slow. In 2011, the National Academy of Sciences issued a report saying that the FDA should set limits on the sodium content in different categories of food. Snack food would have one limit, soups another, cold cuts another, and so on. So that's 2010. The FDA immediately said it would not have mandatory limits, but it would go for voluntary limits. So here we are 9 years later. We still don't have voluntary targets for industry to reach. The FDA proposed targets in 2016, 3 years ago, but they have not been finalized. And why not? Because of industry pressure. Now, the FDA commissioner last year said that they would be finalized this year. Now he's gone. I'm not sure what effect that's going to have on his estimate that they'll be, or his commitment that they'll be issued this year. But just in recent days, Politico, the political newspaper, had an article saying that the food industry, led by the snack food industry, but broader than that, is lobbying to have further delays in the finalization of the targets. And then just to show you how long this will extend, the FDA proposed two kinds of targets. One is a two-year target, so that was originally going to come about in 2018 or 2019, but now it won't be effective till 2021 or 2022, and then 10-year targets. And I just wonder if we might as well forget those. Those would be, if the FDA gets around to finalizing them, we're talking about in the early 2030s before those are finalized. So the timescale is just ridiculous. And the academic support, the research support, is so solid. Countries around the world are taking action. Britain started this 15 years ago. Even countries like South Africa and Turkey are setting limits on sodium in major sources of sodium in their countries. Chile, Israel, Canada have developed very bold warning notices on foods high in sodium. The FDA just hasn't been up to the task.
And one of the things, Dr. Jacobson, that a lot of consumers confront every day is some modicum, and in some cases an overwhelming amount of conflicting evidence, so-called. When it comes to salt, for example, there's a guy named James DiNicolantonio. He's a doctor of pharmacy at St. Luke's Mid-America Heart Institute in Kansas City. He wrote a book a couple of years ago called The Salt Fix, where he actually says that we're not eating nearly enough salt, that if we ate more of it, it would be better. And he refutes the kind of evidence that you're talking about, that, you know, to your mind has been, you know, considered and understood widely for generations. How are consumers supposed to, you know, parse these things? I mean, here's a person who appears to be a legitimate person. He's a cardiovascular researcher, and he's written this book, and he says this is all much ado about nothing.
Well, you said he refutes the evidence on salt's harmfulness. Be more accurate to say he purports to refute the evidence. He's a nobody in this field. And I think what people need to look at is, what does the American Heart Association say, the World Health Organization, the Department of Health and Human Services, the FDA? They all agree that Americans are consuming far more salt, about roughly twice as much salt or sodium as we should be consuming. And there are a few researchers who have done studies that purport to show that too little salt can be harmful. But just a month ago, another committee of the National Academy of Sciences looked at all the evidence, and it said that contrarian evidence, that too little salt is harmful, simply is not high-quality research. And there have been studies that research studies that evaluated the research and have found that it's an artifact of their research methodology that they didn't accurately measure sodium intake. And if you can't measure sodium intake accurately, your research is nothing. So, I'd say people should take news accounts with a big grain of salt. That's the one time I think increased salt consumption is appropriate. And the media, journalists, you guys out there, have been part of the problem, where it's contrarian research, man bites dog kind of stories, attract viewers and readers. And so I think journalists, including ones at the New York Times and the Washington Post, these paragons of journalistic virtue, have really done a disservice to the public by playing up erroneous research.
Of course, it's not just an anti-regulatory environment in which we're living now. There's also just a sort of dismissiveness about science in general. I mean, I think of President Trump's reaction to his own administration's climate report last November. Of course, this follows the president's decision to withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord. But he simply dismissed it and said, I just don't believe it, even though, the science is pretty clear. And the science, in this case, came out of his own administration. I think about the measles and anti-vaxxer movement. CNN has a story just this morning that measles cases worldwide are up nearly 300% from last year. This is a global crisis. It's not just here in the United States, although we've certainly heard about a number of terrible situations here, including just up the road from us in New York and Brooklyn. Theories, as it were, or this frame of mind or interpretation of science, whatever you want to call it, it gets exacerbated in social media. It gets repeated in echo chambers. I mean, what's the best way for good solid science to refute the people who are making these kinds of claims?
Well, I think the science has done the refuting, but some people just refuse to listen to it. And in some cases, I think it's crackpots who've been pushing the connection between immunizations and autism for a couple of decades. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. certainly part of that flock. In other cases, it's companies like Exxon that have questioned climate change, have funded the climate change deniers, the Koch brothers, are involved in that. So it's very different from the anti-vaccination crowd. That's in the United States. I'm not sure about overseas. And I think it falls to the mass media, so the mainstream media, the NPRs, the New York Times, the CNNs, to try to get the word out to people. But there's such an ingrained what's become an ingrained distrust of the media and of science that we're a long way from solving the problem. Look, there are many people who don't even believe in evolution, who deny that evolution has occurred and has been responsible for the species development over the millions of years.
And for example, Mayor de Blasio, Bill de Blasio in New York, declared a health emergency in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, because of the concentration of measles outbreaks there. And he's requiring families to have their children vaccinated. And if not, they're subject to a fine. I think it's $1,000. And there are people, particularly in the Orthodox Jewish community there, who have a religious objection to these vaccinations. Does that put public policy and public officials between a rock and a hard place? I mean, what do you think of Mr. de Blasio's solution to this, the way he's addressing this problem? Do you think that's the most efficacious way of doing it? Are there other arrows that he has in his quiver as well?
Well, there's certainly been education, and that hasn't worked. And as the mayor of a big city, I don't see how he could allow hundreds of people to develop measles, which could be life-threatening, without taking action. So there's nothing in the Bible about vaccinations. You know, I think it's more a cultural than a religious position. And religion exemption from vaccinations really needs to be narrowed greatly, or the potential, there'll be the continued occurrence of measles in this case.
And this was a disease that had been eradicated essentially in the United
States.
But what other things what other actions could Mr. de Blasio or the people in Washington State who are confronting this, the people in California who are confronting this, what other actions can they take once this once these outbreaks have resurfaced?
Well, you know, education of the opposition is a long-term prospect. So I don't know. You know, you have this imminent risk of kids developing measles, and something should be done to protect the kids. And, you know, with climate change, the situation is a little different. There we're talking about not just a few hundred kids, we're talking about planet Earth going down the tubes, and all of our livelihoods, all of major cities along the coasts of every country in the world. And it's very sad that we have an administration that is totally pandering to the oil and gas industries and coal industry on this issue. So, you know, it's to some extent we've got to educate kids, and kids are certainly a lot more environmentally conscious than they were when we were in grammar school. That has to be, you know, we have to continue to do that at the same time taking actions that will protect people right now.
Dr. Michael Jacobson is the senior scientist at the Center for Science in the Public Interest. He'll be appearing at a panel here in Baltimore Wednesday night about food safety and nutrition. He was the head of the Center for Science in the Public Interest for many years. That's a consumer watchdog group that he co-founded in 1971. We will continue our conversation with Dr. Jacobson after a short break. We want to talk about other methods of public policy that can address some of the problems that we're considering today. And we'll take your phone calls at 410-662-8780 or email midday@wypr.org to drop us a tweet at @midday WYPR to follow me on Twitter. It's @TomHallWYPR. Before we go to that break, on Mondays here on Midday, it's our practice to read the names of people who've lost their lives to violence during the previous week. We do so to stand in witness to their untimely deaths, and we remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far here in 2019, 76 people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence. Police have released the identity of a victim whose death was first reported the week before last. His name is Jahl Blackman. He was 38 years old. Last week, 5 people lost their lives to violence in our city. And as of today, police have identified one of them. Her name is Lakeisha Clark. She was 42 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. It's April 15th. It was on this day in 1947 that Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in Major League Baseball, making his debut with the Brooklyn Dodgers. And on this day in 1912, about 1,500 people perished when the Titanic hit an iceberg and sank off the coast of Newfoundland. In 1865, today was the day that President Abraham Lincoln died after having been shot the previous night by John Wilkes Booth. And on this day in 1848, the largest recorded nonviolent escape attempt by slaves in the United States took place in Washington, D.C. It's known as the Pearl Incident. And of course, today is tax day. You have until midnight tonight to file your taxes. If you've just joined us on this history-filled day, my guest is Dr. Michael Jacobson, a co-founder and senior scientist at the Center for Science in the Public Interest. The center publishes the Nutrition Action Health Letter, and we'll have a link to that on our website, wipr.org/midday. Dr. Jacobson is appearing on a panel Wednesday night called Pleasures or Poisons, the Science and Culture of Food. And we've got information about that event on our website as well. If you'd like to join our conversation with Michael Jacobson, our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. You can drop us a tweet at @MiddayWIPR. Dr. Jacobson, we have an email from a listener, Rob, who says, please discuss ways that people can report food safety problems to their local health department, such as the Baltimore City Department of Health. That would include no hot water in food facilities, observed rodents and roaches, food not kept hot or cold, and infection outbreaks such as E. coli. What's your advice for folks who see something and want to say something?
I say yes. I think it's a good email. And I don't have the Baltimore City Health Department phone number handy, but maybe
we do, and we'll put it on our website.
Good, because yes, people absolutely, if they see some problem, the cockroaches or mice crawling around a restaurant, they should report it. And that's something that's easy to do. And it can get inspectors out there pretty quickly. You know, I wanted to mention a few things that a few cities around the country or states are doing to promote the public's health, and things that Baltimore could do also. Philadelphia and New York City require warning notices on high salt foods at chain restaurants. There's an icon of a salt shaker that appears on menus and menu boards. There's precedent. It's been challenged in court and was approved by the courts. An easy thing to do that hopefully would warn people away from excessively salty foods and get restaurants to change their practices. And something that's very easy, where there wouldn't be any industry opposition, is for Baltimore to require that on public property, healthy foods are served and junk foods are excluded or limited. And many, many cities are doing that, state governments. And that's having an impact in what is maybe 10% or 20% of venues where foods are sold. That I don't know if Baltimore has a taxing authority, but some cities have taxed soda pop. It raises millions of dollars that can be used to promote health in one way or another, or in the case of Philadelphia, to have early childhood education, and raises millions of dollars, reduces consumption of soda, and Baltimore City or Baltimore County or together can do that sort of thing.
Well, you know, when it comes to the soda tax, that's an interesting thing that was proposed at one point here in Baltimore. It did not pass. As a matter of fact, they also proposed a bill to simply have signage near sodas when they're for sale in grocery stores and small convenience stores that warn people about the dangers of high sugar contents in foods and childhood obesity and that kind of thing. But the Wall Street Journal just had a piece less than a month ago where they talked about Philadelphia, and they say, quote, that other cities can learn from this spectacle of regret. They're saying that there's a lot of people second-guessing and second-thinking the decision to impose a soda tax in Philadelphia. They're saying that the burden for this tax falls disproportionately on poor people, that it has forced some retailers to lay people off and has reduced their business considerably, and that it's failed to really move the needle. It's failed to create incentives for people to choose healthier drinks. How do you respond to those claims?
Well, there obviously is an incentive to reduce consumption, and that's the higher price. It does affect low-income people disproportionately, but it's easy to evade the tax by buying diet soda, bottled water, just not buying any beverage like that, but using tap water, which is perfectly safe. In California, San Francisco, Oakland, Berkeley, and a couple of other locations in the Bay Area have adopted soda taxes and have seen soda consumption really decrease. And all the tax advocates point out that while taxes on soda might be regressive, the benefits are strongly progressive because it means less health problems for low-income people, and the money can be used to have early childhood education or health education campaigns or to support farmers markets in low-income neighborhoods, that in general, it's a win-win situation. And the soda industry, you know, they own all kinds. They own Coke and Pepsi, sell bottled water. They sell diet sodas, which generally are not taxed. So, you know, it's just like tobacco taxes or alcohol taxes, a very sensible public health measure that needs to be used more widely.
How about labeling? Your organization has been very involved in labels for food going way back to 1990. The Nutrition Labeling and Education Act was signed by President George H.W. Bush in 2010. There's a campaign called Facts Up Front, which had front of the package labeling initiative that was championed by Michelle Obama. Is there evidence that those kinds of things are moving the needle at all in terms of public health? I mean, you walk into a Dunkin' Donuts or a McDonald's or something, you see on the menu board a caloric determination for everything that you can possibly think of ordering in there. Do you think that that's affecting consumers' decisions about what they order?
Well, the nutrition facts label has not been a panacea for dietary problems, but it's invaluable for tens of millions of people who are trying to stick to a higher fiber, lower sodium, or lower cholesterol diet. But it's not the most effective way to change the food supply. Believe it or not, Chile has been the global leader in smart labeling, where Chile requires notices saying high in sodium, high in saturated fat, high in calories on packaged foods that exceed certain thresholds. And Chile has set those thresholds. And if a food is high in calories, sodium, and saturated fat, it has to have three warning signs on it. And these are pretty prominent front of the package warning notices. The food industry hates them. But those labels have led to a tidal wave of reformulations of the foods of processed foods. You know, they clearly are having an impact on what's being sold and what's being consumed. And Chile has done something else related. You know, so they've set those levels at which warning notices have to be used. Then they said, if a food has any warning label, it cannot be advertised to kids. It cannot be sold in schools. So it's really extending the impact of its labeling notice much more broadly in the food supply. That would have a tremendous impact, and that's why Canada, Israel, and some other countries in Latin America are implementing that kind of label.
Speaking of what we're selling to kids and what's available in schools, we mentioned earlier in the program that your organization, the Center for Science and the Public Interest, is one of the complainants in a lawsuit filed this month questioning the rollback rule in which the Trump administration rolled back regulations about what needs to be in school lunches and available to children in schools. And the schools pushed back because they said they had trouble finding foods that were, for example, high in whole grains. They had a hard time finding whole grain pastas and biscuits and tortillas that kids would find appealing. Is that a legitimate argument? Is this stuff still as scarce as evidently some school systems would make us believe?
Well, there may be a few foods that are tough to get in a whole grain form, but about 8 years ago or 6 years ago, the Department of Agriculture came out, finalized its school nutrition regulations. And in the case of sodium, they set three target dates for progressively lower sodium levels. And the food industry squawked from the very beginning. But the first target levels have been met by 98% of schools. And admittedly, they weren't the most challenging targets, but schools met them. And funny thing, when there's a requirement for lower sodium foods, the food industry said, hey, let's market those and sell them to schools. We'll get rich. The Trump administration postponed the second tier of sodium targets for, I think, 4 years to go into effect in 2022 or so. And they killed the third level completely. And that it's tragic because high sodium diets are the most serious dietary problem throughout the world, including the United States. And the time to cultivate a taste for less salty foods is in childhood. So why not get healthier foods in schools? There have been big improvements in school foods. Soft drinks have been thrown out. And, you know, there's little improvements for whole grains and sodium. But we need to do a lot more.
And Mike Jacobson, we have a caller from Baltimore, Phila. Welcome to Midday with Dr. Michael Jacobson.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question. I'm coming in belatedly, but I heard that diet sodas are being touted as healthy, and honestly, from hearing all the studies that have been done around aspartame and sucralose and these artificial sweeteners having dire effects on health and cancer and other diseases, I'm quite stunned and rather appalled.
All right. Well, thanks for that comment, Phila. Yeah, but what about that? Diet sodas, you know, do have these chemical sweeteners. We got about 30 seconds left, Doctor. What do you think?
I think most of those sweeteners either have been shown to cause cancer or are inadequately tested. Stevia is probably an exception. But I think the 10 teaspoons of sugar in a regular soda far, far outweigh the small risk from those sweeteners. And diet sodas have been tested against regular sodas in terms of obesity in kids. And in these controlled studies, diet sodas don't promote weight gain. Regular sodas do promote weight gain.
Dr. Michael Jacobson is the chief scientist at the Center for Science in the Public Interest. Dr. Jacobson will be joining a panel of food experts on Wednesday night at 7 o'clock at the Doubletree Hilton Hotel in Pikesville. And that event is part of the Great Talk series. It's entitled Pleasures or Poisons, the Science and Culture of Food. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/midday. Mike Jacobson, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom. I greatly enjoyed being on.
That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, it's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. We're going to examine the terrible problem of sex trafficking. Our region is located on the I-95 corridor, and as such, human trafficking is a huge problem. Sherry and I will be joined by Jessica Emerson, the director of the University of Baltimore's Human Trafficking Project, and Jean Alert, the founder of the Samaritan Women Institute for Shelter Care. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday Culture Connections here on Midday. We want to thank the Diz for providing lunch today. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner, and they serve breakfast on the weekends. You can find them on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. Here and Now is up next at the top of the hour after the news from NPR. I'm Tom Hall. Appreciate your joining us. Have a great day.
This is 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station.